Ancient Colchis was the land where, according to Greek mythology, Jason and the Argonauts went in search of the Golden Fleece. Now, some beautiful gold and silver objects from 5th and 4th century BC graves in the ancient Colchis city of Vani are making their first ever North American appearance in a new exhibit called Wine, Worship, and Sacrifice at NYU's Institute for the Study of the Ancient World. Jennifer Chi is curator, and Roger Bagnall is ISAW director and former professor of classics and history at Columbia. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Where was ancient Colchis?
Well, it's located on the east shore of the Black Sea, and it's a land that we know about through the myth of Jason and the Golden Fleece.
So the Greeks would have gone through the Mediterranean, through the Bosporus, and into the Black Sea?
That's right. And there are colonies, Greek colonies, all along the northern shore of the Black Sea, as well as Greek emporia, trading posts on the shoreline of Colchis.
And what is the country now?
It's the Republic of Georgia.
Which part of Georgia? The part that's still a part of Georgia, or the part that is trying to not be a part of Georgia?
it's the part that is trying to be Georgia.
If Colchis was so important in Jason and the Argonauts myth, what was its relationship to the ancient Greek world? Were there reasons that the Greeks wanted to go there?
Well, the Greeks found the Black Sea very important for a whole bunch of raw materials and foodstuffs. They got a lot of wheat from the Black Sea, and they were in search of precious metals, which Greece itself mostly wasn't very rich in.
But there were other empires that were closer, the Assyrian and the Persian. Were the Greeks in competition with them?
Oh, yes, very much. The Assyrians were there in Colchis. Colchis appears in Assyrian inscriptions. And the Persians were there, and there's certainly Persian influence on the art of the area. So, there were other people interested.
Because this is a strategic location.
Very.
It's on the coastline of the Black Sea, and then it's very close to the Persian Empire. So it really is a crossroads civilization. And you see influence coming directly from the Greek mainland, from Black Sea cities, as well as from the Persian Empire.
What about the other way? Does the Colchis culture have things that are unique to it?
It definitely has a very strong indigenous culture, and you see that in the gold work itself, in the typology of the gold work, as well as the composition and in some of the iconography. But what's really fascinating about it, and I think why Roger and I were so thrilled to have this as our inaugural exhibition, is because a lot of the gold work includes influence or shows influence from the Scythians, from the Persian Empire, as well as from the Greek world. Yet, they are very uniquely Colchian in shape and form.
And beautifully crafted.
Exquisitely crafted. Really, some of the gold work it really rivals other gold work that I've seen in the greatest museums in the world. So,
and this is the 5th and 4th centuries B.C., so we're going back pretty far. Would similar work be done in Greece, for example, in Athens at the time?
Definitely. And you do see, as I said, influence in the iconography coming from Greece. And there was a definite connection. We don't know if Greek craftsmen were going to Colchis and teaching Colchians how to craft this gold or vice versa. But we do know that there was a workshop in Vani itself producing this gold.
Now, where in Colchis is Vani located? And is there a modern-day Vani?
There is, yeah. It's a relatively small town there. There are houses still occupying part of the ancient site, in fact. Sort of nested.
You mean houses that are thousands of years old?
No, modern houses. Oh. And they're undoubtedly sitting on top of more of these graves and probably other parts of the ancient city as well, sort of nestled in the foothills of the Caucasus Mountains. Georgia is a land with tremendous ecological contrast. You get everything from tea plantations on the Black Sea coast to the High Caucasus, and therefore you can grow just about anything there in one zone or another.
And that includes wine grapes.
Indeed.
Was this an early place for wine?
Yes,
did
indeed.
The Greeks bring it to them, or did they bring it to the Greeks?
Well, we don't know what the relationship there is, or it may have been a lot more circuitous than that. But Georgia is the place where the earliest evidence of the domestication of the grape for winemaking has been found.
That dates to the 6th millennium BC. There are some jugs that have been discovered in excavations that show wine resin on them.
I'm sure going through graves, you didn't find out about how they made wine in Vani. But
No. That's not something that we really explore. But what is very interesting is that the grave goods that you find in these very wealthy graves show evidence of wine drinking through cups and banqueting elements that are included as grave goods.
Actually, there is one wine vat at the site, and we saw other later winemaking facilities around the country too. And, of course, there's a very lively wine culture today.
Mm-hmm. In fact, Georgian wine was the most popular wine in the Soviet Union until just recent tensions have suddenly led the Russians to put all sorts of tariffs on it. But I hear Russians are really missing that great Georgian wine.
Yes, I think so. But ironically, it may actually benefit the Georgians because since they have to sell the wine to a world audience now, they're likely to raise the standard and make it even more competitive.
Now, how did anyone know where these graves were? Has this been a site that people have recognized as rich in artifacts for a long time?
Well, systematic excavation started in the 1940s, and really from that point on, the excavations were yielding an incredible amount of grave goods, as well as there was exploration of a lot of architectural complexes. And from the 1960s forward, there was a man called Otar Lord Kipanidze who really regularized excavations there and made sure that the material was published for a wider audience.
Is this one of those places where you just start digging and you find stuff underneath? Without working very deep into the ground?
There are certainly accidental discoveries going back to the last century.
I mean, that's what happens in Mexico City,
yes,
for example.
Exactly. No, I think the accidental discoveries got people to realize that this was a fabulous source of antiquities. Mm-hmm. We're lucky that so much of it survived to be excavated scientifically in recent decades.
I'm assuming also looting has been a problem, as it is everywhere else where there is excavation of rich sites.
There actually isn't really that much looting, or at least from my conversations with the archaeologists there. There's a real strong local pride at Vani, and the citizens of Vani really feel a very protective sense towards the site.
I'm so disappointed. I was hoping to get some inexpensive black market stuff because the working here is just stunningly beautiful. What kind of technologies did they have? Do we know?
What
kinds of tools were they working with?
Well, we know that there was a workshop, as I said, at Vani. We know that they were using granulation. That's a type of technique that's used to decorate the surface of gold. It's small, minute balls of gold used to create decorative elements on the surface of such objects. And that's a technique that actually dates back to the 3rd millennium BC, and you see it in Sumer. And that was a technique that was passed down through the ages. The Greeks used it, as well as the Colchians, and even the Persians used this too.
Was this a special grave site, or is this just the local cemetery?
Very interestingly, in the Greek world, you have a separate area, a cemetery, a necropolis, where you would bury your dead. It seems at Vani, this is not the case, that people were living in the city and that there were areas throughout the city where the deceased were buried, but that they didn't have a separate site or cemetery. They're, in fact, living near these graves.
And is there significance as to what they put in the graves? Because we see different kinds of things in Greek graves as opposed to Egyptian graves, for example.
Well, we selected four graves dating to the 5th and 4th century BC. And to a large extent, you see a principal deceased who is just adorned with a really vast amount of jewelry from head to the neck to the arms.
We get the skeletal remains?
There are some skeletal remains. And from some graves, you can say that the principal deceased was a man or a woman. But what's very interesting is that not only do you have this incredible wealth and opulence in the gold work, but you also have a principal deceased that's surrounded by grave goods made out of precious materials such as silver and bronze, most of which is related to winemaking and consumption, and perhaps reflecting a funerary banquet. And when I say principles deceased, this is something also very interesting about the graves, is that there seems to be evidence of the sacrifice of retainers or household slaves or servants. When the principal deceased died, they would take servants with them to the afterlife in hopes of having a similar life in the afterlife to that on earth.
So what is this religion related to? Not Greek. That sounds more Egyptian to me.
I think it's distinctly indigenous. There really aren't any parallels. I mean, there are parallels for the sacrifice of retainers, but really the culture there was strikingly indigenous, even though it's at a crossroads and is accepting influence from other cultures. It's strikingly.
Yeah, they borrow things unique from the Greeks, but they borrow them on their own terms and on their own time.
We're talking about an exhibit called Wine, Worship, and Sacrifice at NYU's Institute for the Study of the Ancient World, and with us is the director of the Institute, Roger Bagnall, and the curator of the show, Jennifer Chi. And by the way, you can see a little slideshow that we have posted on our show page at WNYC.org, give you an idea of what we've been talking about. There were also tablets, weren't there? Are there tablets with inscriptions on them? No?
What's very interesting about Vani and about Colchis in general is that there doesn't appear to be a written language until the 3rd century BC when Greek is adopted in the area. And I think the tablets that you're referring to might be the terracotta roof tiles that were stamped with basilike, which means king.
So that's much later.
It is later. Vani was founded in the 8th century BC. And survived through to, or really was a thriving city from the 6th century BC when it was, and then destroyed in the 1st century BC by invading Hellenistic rulers.
Are all of the objects on display on loan from the Georgia National Museum?
Yes. This is a loan show of material from the excavations. Some of it is actually from last summer's excavation.
This is continuing to this day.
Oh, yes. The
excavation. Is this a treasure trove? Are we assuming there's a lot more down there?
We do assume there's a lot more there, yes.
Only about a quarter of the city has been excavated.
Yes. So.
And we were fortunate enough to have the Georgia National Museum loan us material that was excavated last season.
Indeed, the two most spectacular things in the show, from my point of view, are these bronze elephant head incense burners or lamps, which were found last summer, which have never been seen on display anywhere.
And elephants, I guess, would have been seen in the area, even though they're not indigenous.
Probably not.
There's probably Hellenistic influence from the Seleucid world coming from Indian elephants having been brought west for use in warfare between the kings in the period after Alexander the Great.
What are the logistics of putting a show like this together? I mean, we are talking about some priceless treasures here, aren't we?
It's not an easy process, just in the sense of the amount of administration that one has to go through, particularly in putting together an international loan show. But I do have to say that working with the Georgia National Museum was a great pleasure. They really wanted this material to be seen in North America. Bringing the objects over and installing them in a way that's understandable because they are so unique was really what the challenge was for us. And we came up with a very innovative way, I think, in installing the objects in the sense that we looked at archaeological reports and we looked at photographs of the excavations. And from those, we learned how these very unique objects were worn by the person. And our display concept was to emulate that. And you can walk through our galleries and really get a feeling of how this person was laid to rest and how rich these graves really were.
Do we have any sense of what their clothing was like? Textiles usually don't last six millennia.
Exactly. It's a very, very humid environment there. And the first thing really to deteriorate when something is buried is textiles. So we don't really have an idea.
Now, one of the complaints about the King Tut exhibits was that people went to see the gold rather than to learn much about the ancient world. Are you concerned at all about that?
Yes, indeed. And we have not found, actually, that people ignored the other things, but that's partly because we've got labels and graphics that attempt to explain the whole thing and put it into context, and partly because the non-gold material is just about as spectacular as the gold, so people spend as much time looking at the bronzes as they do with the gold work.
You can see Wine, Worship, and Sacrifice through June 1st at NYU's Institute for the Study of the Ancient World. It's at 15 East 84th Street, and admission is free.
That's right.
That's rare. The hours are Tuesday through Sunday. For more information, you can give them a call at 212-992-7800 or go to our show page at WNYC.org. There's also a marvelous catalog, which is published by you.
Yes.
And we
distributed by Princeton University Press.
And we want to thank the two of you for being here, Roger Bagnall and Jennifer Chi. We've been talking about Wine, Worship, and Sacrifice, three of my favorite pastimes.
Thank you.
Thank you.